Costume Drama Rewind, where your hosts, Laura Skog
and Megan Jutt,
are giving you a holiday surprise. We're serving up a double episode. We're doing Joyeux Noël, which is about the Christmas truce of 1914, and the movie 1917, which is inspired by the wartime memoirs of Lance Corporal Alfred H. Mendez. While you've probably heard of the movie 1917, you might not be as familiar with Joyeux Noël. However, both of them are about World War I, and both of them are going to make you do some real ugly crying.
Which, admittedly, happens to me with coffee commercials.
Joyeux Noël came out in 2005. It's directed by Christian Carrion, and it stars Diane Kruger, Benno Furman, Guillaume Canet, Gary Lewis, Danny Boone, Daniel Brühl, and Stephen Robertson, with a guest appearance by the late and great Ian Richardson.
1917 was released on Christmas Day 2019. It's directed by Sam Mendes, Alfred Mendes's grandson, and stars George MacKay and Dean Charles Chapman, with blink and you miss them cameos from Colin Firth, Andrew Scott, Mark Strong, Richard Madden, and the ever-burning light of my life, Benedict Cumberbatch. Laura's kicking off with a quick synopsis, or perhaps not so quick synopsis, of Joyeux Noël.
It is 1914, and the Great War has just been declared. We meet some of the main characters we're following through the movie. Jonathan and William, two brothers from Scotland who enlisted together, and their parish priest, Father Palmer, who comes along as their regiment's chaplain. There's Lieutenant Audebert, played by Guillaume Canet, who can't get in touch with his wife behind the lines, and whose dad is a general who wants him to transfer to a more prestigious branch of the army. And Nikolaus Schrenk, played by Benno Furman, a singer whose operatic career in Berlin with his Danish sweetheart Anna Sorensen, aka Diane Kruger, gets interrupted literally by the announcement of war, a la Lord Grantham breaking up his own garden party in season one of Downton Abbey.
Party foul!
While the war is proving highly unpleasant, despite the talks about everything being over by Christmas, Diane Kruger is using her celebrity status to get Crown Prince Wilhelm to sign off on Schrenk doing a concert with her for German military leadership. She's happily reunited with him, even though he's already changed by the horrors of war, and he's teeming with head lice. He decides that he wants to go back early to the front line to share his music with his fellow soldiers, not the pompous officers. She's also got an extremely convenient pass to go basically wherever she wants, given to her by the Kaiser himself, so off they go back to the trenches. During this time, we've seen Jonathan's brother get killed. Audebert hasn't gotten letters from his pregnant wife in ages, and he doesn't even know if she's still alive. Come Christmas Eve, it's a pretty quiet and dismal affair, though Father Palmer tries to entertain the Scottish troops with his bagpipes, and they sing a few songs. Schrenk and Kruger show back up on the German side, and he starts singing. Palmer begins accompanying him on the bagpipes for Silent Night. Inspired, Schrenk hops over the trench and goes to the middle of the battlefield with one of the Christmas trees that High Command has had placed along the line, and he gets applause from the French and Scottish. Lieutenant Gordon, played by Alex Ferns, Lieutenant Horsemeyer, played by Daniel Brühl, and Lieutenant Audebert scuttle out, and they agree to a truce for the evening. Men from all three armies begin mingling, showing off pictures of their wives and sweethearts, and share treats. Father Palmer also conducts a mass, and nearly everyone appears to take part, whether they're Catholic or not, as he later remarks, just to be together. The next morning, the truce continues, with the officers from all three regiments meeting over coffee and deciding to allow everyone to bury their dead. Jonathan, who slept curled up by the body of his brother, finally buries William, though he still writes to their mother as if he's alive and a war hero. There's also a soccer match and a card game, and some of the soldiers make plans to reunite once the war ends. All this fraternization at last comes to a head. Horsemeyer receives word that the German artillery will soon shell the Allied trenches, and he makes the dramatic decision to invite the French and Scottish troops to shelter in the German trenches. Then, of course, the Allied troops return the favor, knowing that their own artillery will retaliate. At last, though, everyone has to go home, realizing this can't go on indefinitely, and the officers realize there will be consequences. Horsemeyer also learns that Schrenk left headquarters without permission and was thought to have deserted, so he's going to face a short imprisonment. During the confusion as everyone returns to their lines, Schrenk and Anna defect, asking Audebert to take them as prisoners of the French army so they won't be separated again. Military censors from both sides begin reading letters home detailing all that went on, and the consequences are swift. Audebert's father has him reassigned, Gordon is forced to order the killing of an unarmed German, who turns out to actually be a French soldier in disguise who snuck home to see his mother. And Horsemeyer and his men get personally insulted by the Crown Prince and sent to the Eastern Front as a punishment. Father Palmer gets removed from the army, and the bishop in charge, played by Ian Richardson, preaches an angry sermon to the Scottish soldiers about the Germans' lack of humanity. However, the men who participate in the truce, and to whom the film is dedicated, keep the lessons they learned that Christmas, as seen with Horsemeyer and his men singing the songs the Scots taught them as the movie ends.
They will honor Christmas in their hearts and try to keep it all the year, to borrow from our last episode.
Or at least as long as they live, which may not be long.
So, yeah, okay, I'm admitting defeat. In no way short synopsis of 1917. The film takes place mostly on April 6th, 1917, a really important day in World War I history for reasons that our characters don't know about yet and that we'll get into in a little bit, but that have absolutely no impact on the quest that they're about to undertake. The movie opens with a sleeping Lance Corporal Blake, played by Dean Charles Chapman, who is summoned to see a General Aranmore and instructed to pick a friend to accompany him. He chooses Lance Corporal Schofield, played by George MacKay. In the officer's tent, the general, played by Colin Firth, who won't be back again in this movie, informs the two that they need to get a message to the 2nd Battalion of the Devonshire Regiment, who are currently about 9 miles away on the other side of No Man's Land, and who have planned an attack the next morning. That attack, Aranmore informs them, is a trap. But with phone lines cut by the German retreat, their only option is to send the message on foot. They've chosen Blake because his brother is serving with the 2nd Devons, so no pressure. The two take off, Blake impetuously, moving as fast as he can. Schofield more slowly and cautiously. After a brief meeting with a drunk, fatalistic Andrew Scott, who will not be back in this movie, they really blew a lot of their budget on cameos. It's okay, I'm here for it. They set out across No Man's Land, which is exactly as stressful as it sounds, full of all the most vivid horrors of war, but they manage to reach the abandoned German trenches on the other side. A rat sets off a tripwire, caving in the trench and nearly trapping Schofield under the rubble, but Blake manages to pull him out. Next, they happen along an abandoned cottage, which at first seems like a haven. There are blooming cherry trees and fresh milk.
It's a trap!
They watch a dog fight in the air above them and dash out of the way as a damaged German plane nearly crashes into them. They drag the pilot from the wreckage and put out his flaming legs, and Blake is insistent on trying to help him, sending Schofield running for water. Schofield turns back around to see the wounded pilot pull a knife out of Blake's abdomen that he had just plunged in. Blake tries to rally, but it becomes apparent that he won't survive. He instructs Schofield to take his personal effects and ensures that he understands the route that's still to be taken before dying in his arms in a scene that is incredibly painful to watch and almost too painful to describe. Schofield only has a moment with his grief, though, because a truck of fellow British soldiers pulls up, captained by Mark Strong, who will not be back in this movie. They bring him aboard and get him a few miles further down the road, but the bridge across the next river is out, and he can't afford to divert. He takes his chances climbing across the down bridge, but a sniper is waiting for him. A gunfight ensues, and in rushing the sniper's perch inside a nearby building, Schofield is shot and blacks out. When he wakens, it's almost dawn. He takes off running for the nearby town, but finds that it's full of trigger-happy German soldiers. Stumbling into what appears to be an abandoned building for cover, he finds a young French woman hiding with a baby, and they're able to exchange a few words and a few moments of human comfort. He unloads tins of food from his pack for her, and he even has milk for the baby. She cleans his wounds and confirms that his final destination is just ahead. Schofield takes off in a desperate run, dodging fire. He makes it to the river that he's aiming for and plunges in, carried downstream by the raging waters before washing up against a dam made largely of human bodies.
Fun!
He staggers out of the river and finds himself in the middle of a company of soldiers preparing for battle. Surprise! He's found the 2nd Devons, but the attack that he's trying to call off has already begun. In one more desperate sprint, he finds the colonel, played by a bee-mustached Benedict Cumberbatch, who initially resists the order to stand down the attack. Schofield finally convinces him that they are in fact walking into a trap, and Cumberbatch reluctantly orders the 2nd Devons to withdraw, telling Schofield, "There is only one way this war ends. Last man standing."
Doesn't he say it like, "There is only one way this war ends. Last man standing"?
You leave Benedict Cumberbatch alone. An exhausted Schofield has just enough left in the tank to look for Blake's brother, and actually finds him alive and whole in a twist that we were frankly not expecting. He delivers Blake's personal effects and the news of his death, And we close with Schofield resting under a tree, gazing lovingly at photos of his wife and children. First impressions.
For 1917, I knew this movie existed, but I never have really ever gotten into most army films. I'm more of a naval battle kind of gal.
We know.
Did you know? However, I'm glad you recommended it because I thought it was really moving and it was really well done.
So 1917 was supposed to be a fun, relaxing movie date night with my husband last January. Fun! Relaxing! Instead, it was the single most stressful cinematic experience of my life. It felt like getting hit in the face with a board for 2 hours, which turned out to be a pretty decent foreshadowing for 2020, but also in a completely brilliant way. So for Joie Noël, I knew the story of the Christmas truce pretty well, and what I'd expected from this movie was just sort of a straightforward, feel-good Christmas movie, and what we ended up getting was something way better than that.
Actually, with Joyeux Noël, my reaction going into it was, oh good, this is going to be super depressing. And it was, but definitely a movie with layers, and I really appreciated what they did with it.
When we talk about depressing, you made me watch The Lighthouse.
That's not depressing.
Yeah.
That's, in your words, disturbing.
Let's get right down to the heart of the matter, starting with 1917. So, like I said earlier, April 6th, 1917 turned out to be a game-changing day in the history of World War I. That was the day that the U.S. House of Representatives took the final vote to enter World War I, which had already been underway for nearly 3 years, racking up millions of casualties. The first U.S. troops would deploy to Europe by the end of June. Meanwhile, 1917 was already a pretty busy year on the geopolitical front. The U.S. had severed diplomatic ties with Germany in February, in response to both Germany's use of submarine warfare against neutral shipping, and also the interception of a telegram the previous month from German Foreign Secretary Arthur Zimmermann, encouraging Mexico to declare war on the U.S. Party foul. In March, British troops captured the city of Baghdad, while in Russia, Tsar Nicholas II bowed to revolutionary forces and surrendered the throne. Meanwhile, as Schofield and Blake set out on their very long walk, elsewhere on the Western Front, Canadian troops in northern France were getting ready to fight their best-known battle of the war. The Battle of Vimy Ridge began on April 9th with a mandate to capture a tactically important piece of high ground that overlooked the French lines. Previous attempts by the French army to take the ridge had resulted in more than 100,000 casualties. The Canadian troops took Vimy Ridge over the course of 3 blood-soaked days, with more than 10,000 casualties in that time, a victory that is so important to the nation of Canada that in 1922, the French government ceded the ridge to them in perpetuity. So that's what was going on around Blake and Schofield during their odyssey, events of tremendous importance that they wouldn't have known about for days or weeks, which I think is an interesting statement about how people experienced history before the age of instant communication.
In 1917, we see Schofield and Blake wind their way through a maze of trenches on the British side at the very beginning of the movie. I had originally thought that the trenches were literally just a few ditches here and there, not that deep, so I wondered how accurate this depiction was. And it is! Smithsonian Magazine says that trench networks were incredibly complex, encompassing separate front lines, secondary support, communication, food, and latrine trenches. They required a very specific means of moving around and communicating, limiting opportunities to cross lines and venture into no man's land at will. But the movie doesn't show just how miserable they were. The Canadian War Museum's online exhibit says that trench life involved long periods of boredom mixed with brief periods of terror. The threat of death kept soldiers constantly on edge, while poor living conditions and a lack of sleep wore away at their health and stamina. Those poor conditions included disease-carrying lice and rats. Additionally, because they're literally in the ground, they could be at risk of drowning if things got flooded, or at the very least, perpetually damp. Soldiers would come down with trench foot, a condition caused by dampness that produces itching, swelling, numbness, and eventual decay. And also, trench fever, a serious bacterial infection which was spread by lice. This was live for both sides, but because the German forces were on the offensive and started building their trench system first, they were generally able to pick higher and better ground, which gets referenced in Joyeux Noël. They were also able to rig up electric lights as well.
So I commented a few times while I was watching 1917, at least the first half, that I got a real Frodo and Sam vibe from our two leads. Schofield is sadder and more serious, while Blake is optimistic, full of jokes and stories, and he's also very food-motivated.
Just like me.
Like all of us these days. In fact, we know that World War I did a lot to shape The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien deployed to France in 1916 as a 24-year-old second lieutenant, serving in the Battle of the Somme for nearly 4 months before acquiring a case of trench fever that kept him away from the front for the rest of the war, which is at least a blessing for him and the nerds of the world, since his battalion was almost completely wiped out not long after he was taken to the hospital.
Thank heavens for head lice.
But what he saw in the war echoed throughout all of his later writings, and his description of the Siege of Gondor really mirrors the Western Front's no man's land. Quote, all before the walls on either side of the gate, the ground was choked with wreck and with bodies of the slain, yet still driven as by a madness, more and more came up. If you're interested in how the war affected Tolkien and his buddy C.S. Lewis, I highly recommend the book A Hobbit, Wardrobe, and a Great War by Professor Joseph LeConte from the King's College, New York. On to Joyeux Noël. The Christmas truce is one of those things that sometimes happens in history that sounds like fiction, but is actually largely true. Early in the month of December 1914, Pope Benedict XV proposed an official Christmas ceasefire, a suggestion which both sides politely ignored. But in fact, all along the Western Front on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, regiments from both sides got together to sing carols, trade hard-to-find little luxuries like chocolate and tobacco, play soccer, and retrieve and bury their dead from no man's land. While fighting continued in some places along the line, it's estimated that as many as 100,000 soldiers took part in these spontaneous celebrations. The first reports of what had happened broke in the New York Times on New Year's Eve, with British papers picking up the story the following week. The British newspapers took a generally pretty positive tone, praising the soldiers involved for their humanity, while German papers tended to be more critical, and French papers censored the story entirely. In any case, high command on both sides of the war took great pains to discourage similar demonstrations in the years that followed.
The opera singer Schrenk, played by Benno Fehrmann, is actually based on Walter Kirchhoff, a Wagnerian tenor with the Berlin Opera. Unlike Schrenk, who gets drafted and sent to the front, the German government made Kirchhoff a major and aide-de-camp to the Crown Prince because he was considered too valuable to waste as a normal soldier, and he was basically just stuck in a cushy desk job, it sounds like. According to his great-nephew Michael von Berg's account on the Australian Virtual War Memorial website, it was actually Kirchhoff's idea to send Christmas trees to the front. His visit to the troops turned into the Christmas truce when the French and Scottish forces began applauding his singing. Unlike Schrenk, who decided to put the trees on the trenches in the movie, Kirchhoff didn't do that. The soldiers did it themselves in real life. He also didn't desert from the German army, as he was back performing on stage in Germany a few days later. And sadly enough, I have seen no evidence of a super hot blonde opera singer accompanying him to the front.
Down, girl. So music actually plays a huge role in setting the emotional tone of the whole film. The song that kicks off the festivities, I'm Dreaming of Home, is sung by the Scottish soldiers early on Christmas Eve, and it's not a period original, but actually a song that was written especially for this film by an American songwriter. The song was later chosen to be played at the 90th anniversary commemoration of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. From there, they rolled into Silent Night, or Stille Nacht.
Close enough.
Probably the carol most directly associated with the historical Christmas truce. That carol dates back to 1816, when a young Austrian priest named Joseph Moore penned it as a six-stanza poem expressing his vision of peace in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. 2 years later, he's hastily preparing for midnight mass on Christmas Eve. Father Moore asks a friend to beat out a hasty arrangement on guitar, and one of the world's best-known carols is born in a short 2 hours, in a victory for procrastinators everywhere.
Woo!
From there, the impromptu trench performance, which now includes singing, bagpiping, and harmonica, rolls into Adeste Fideles, better known as O Come All Ye Faithful, which may date back as far as the 13th century. During the celebration of Midnight Mass, Anna, a.k.a. Diane Kruger, graces us with Schubert's hymn Ave Maria, literally Hail Mary. Finally, both sides mark their final parting from each other with perhaps the world's most poignant and tear-jerking bagpipe performance of Auld Lang Syne, written by Scotland's national poet Robbie Burns. Yeah, my Scottish accent totally failed on that one. But music really serves a powerful role in this film as a way to communicate across cultures, and also as a way to make me sob like a little girl.
You sob at everything.
Yeah, it's why you love me.
At the very beginning of the movie, we get French and British kids reciting creepy propaganda poems about how it's their sacred duty to exterminate the Germans, and German kids reciting similar stuff about the English. While anti-German sentiment exploded in the US after entering into World War I, deep resentment between Germany and the French and British developed leading up to World War I, particularly because of the rise in Germany's military power following its unification from a bunch of mini-kingdoms and principalities into a unified country. As a buffer against this fear of German military power, the French and British government signed the Entente Cordiale in 1904. This treaty, which was primarily about the empire's colonies, acknowledged France's full control over Morocco, which Germany was not too pleased about. So the Kaiser announced his support for the Sultan of Morocco against the French, and the German counselor von Bülow basically dropped hints about going to war over this. Things got patched over with an international conference, but this first Moroccan crisis, along with another incident in 1911, soured sentiments against Germany. And France and Germany also had bad relations in the 19th and 20th century thanks to the Franco-Prussian War in 1870 and 1871, in which France was forced to give up regions of Alsace and Lorraine. You may have noticed that the French kid's creepy poem even references Alsace. As mentioned, France entered into alliances with Britain, but they also did this with Russia during the late 19th and early 20th century, so it was basically France, UK, and Russia stacked up against Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire by the time World War I rolled around.
So I think the most important theme woven into both movies are all the ways that people try to cling to their humanity during wartime, and about the unintended and maybe undeserved consequences that can have. In 1917, of course, Blake's show of compassion for the downed German pilot is literally what gets him killed. Later, because of that, we hold our breath when Schofield shows compassion for the young woman and baby, and it turns into a really lovely moment. In Joyeux Noël, meanwhile, we have lots of little acts of humanity shared around, and they get bigger as time goes on. Sharing chocolate and champagne turns into passing letters back and forth for family members on either side of the lines, turns into sheltering one another in their own trenches. And of course, we see how well that works out for them.
Not well.
Other themes that carry through both movies include the sometimes high-handed attitudes of superior officers toward the enlisted men, the longing of men on both sides to be home and to be with their families, and the various ways in which civilians were caught in the middle. So now the big question, how many hats are we awarding to these two films?
For 1917, hold on to your seats, kids, because I'm doing a first and giving, for the first time on this podcast, a full 5. Metal Tommy helmets. Doo-doo! I thought this movie seamlessly weaves in so many elements about World War I that are cultural touchpoints at this point. References to it being silent on the front, showing the civilians that are caught up in the middle, talking about the war being over by Christmas, showing someone experiencing shell shock, etc., etc., without feeling derivative of other movies, books, and shows. And I liked how they worked in so many details. Smithsonian Magazine says, "The toll exacted by the conflict isn't simply told through the duo's encounters with the enemy, instead it's written to the very fabric of the movie's landscape, from the carcasses of livestock and cattle caught in the war's crosshairs, to rolling hills comprised of dirt and corpses, and countryside dotted with bombed villages." And I also appreciated the Odyssey vibes. For Joyeux Noël, I'm going to go with 4 Pickle Halba helmets. These are the spiky German hats. I really like the subtle symbolism of the candles being snuffed out at the beginning of the movie.
The lamps are going out all over Europe.
As well as the authority figures who keep saying how different the other side is, how barbaric. Like the creepy poems the creepy kids are reciting at the beginning, and the bishop's sermon at the end of the movie. But we're shown all throughout just how alike they are, clutching onto the same type of photos of their loved ones, enjoying the same treats. They even all name parts of their trench systems. Whether it's Friedrichstrasse on the German side, King Street on the Scottish. And I did enjoy the roast beef land and froggy street signs. There are references to insults the British and French have for each other. And all 3 of the officers who decide to have the truce are alike. They're all young. They all have some sort of conflicted feeling, such as Horstmeier having a French wife. and they're all feeling the same pressures of knowing that they'll be answering for their roles in the truce. And I really like that they use French, German, and English instead of just going with one language. I am knocking a point off, though, for the whole Diane Kruger story. It's not historically accurate, and it does feel just sort of like a tack-on to get a celebrity name in there.
So despite that, I am going to take this opportunity to be really incredibly smug.
Only this opportunity?
Shut up. Because both of these films were my suggestions, and you were very skeptical about both of them.
Because they're depressing.
Have you met yourself? You were extremely skeptical. And that's two glowing reviews in a row, which I will fully echo. Both of these movies deserved all of the lavish critical acclaim that they received at their time of release. They are both absolute works of art that say really important things about compassion and mercy, and both offer fresh takes on their respective stories. For Joyeux Noël, about an event that's really been heavily mythologized, and for 1917, for sort of a meta-narrative about the war itself. I am awarding a full 5 Picklehalba helmets. I know I didn't say that right.
It's okay.
To Joyeux Noël and 5 Tommy helmets to 1917, and will now rest on my laurels as a person with excellent taste.
Oh, gosh.
There'll be no living with her after this. Finally, a few sundry other notes. We always have to keep our actor count updated. And to my very great joy, 1917 marks Benedict Cumberbatch's 3rd episode with us, having previously appeared in Amazing Grace and The Abominable Bride. Andrew Scott is making his 2nd appearance, having shown up briefly in The Abominable Bride as Sherlock's nemesis James Moriarty. Adrian Scarborough, who plays Major Hepburn, was in Gosford Park as one of the members of staff. And finally, it has taken a shocking 15 episodes for Colin Firth to turn up on this podcast for the first time, but I am confident in saying that now that he knows the way, he'll be back. Meanwhile, in Joyeux Noël, Stephen Robertson plays Jonathan, the Scottish soldier whose brother gets killed, and he previously appeared on this podcast as serial killer Malcolm Crawley in the 1st season of The Bletchley Circle. It's also worth pointing out that my first encounter with Diane Kruger was when she played Dr. Abigail Chase in National Treasure.
Me too!
A movie that I was obsessed with in my early college years, which both dates me and, you know, tells on me. But for that, I declare Diane Kruger to be costume drama adjacent.
I'll allow it. I love opera, so I wanted to point out that singers Natalie Desaye and Rolando Villazon did the singing voices for Diane Kruger and Benno Furman. Also, the aria they perform for the Crown Prince is Bist du bei mir from Gottfried Heinrich Stölzel's 1718 opera, Diomedes. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah.
And it's more famously arranged by Bach and his wife. The lyrics are pretty foreshadowing with, "If you are with me, then I will go gladly unto my death and to my rest." And in the movie, Schrenk criticizes Crown Prince Wilhelm and the other military leadership for not really knowing or caring what's going on with the front line. And he does have a point. The Crown Prince was in charge of the 5th Army, even though he really had very little military leadership experience, along with a lot of his other aristocrat military buddies, and he basically had to lean on more seasoned officers for advice. He did lead the Siege of Verdun in 1916, though, and he got the nickname Butcher of Verdun later. However, as the war went on, he began to believe that the Germans couldn't win and they should sue for peace, but his suggestions were shot down repeatedly. As a result of the German Revolution that began in 1918, he and his father had to abdicate and a republic was created. They were in exile in Holland for about 5 years. They also both signed the Treaty of Versailles, which ended the war. And I love the cat who would visit both the French and German troops. And while watching the movie, I kept making notes about how I am going to lose it if anything happens to the cat. So I regret to inform you that in real life, the French troops ended up being forced to shoot the poor kitty for being a traitor.
R.I.P. traitor cat.
Not a traitor.
So there's a fun little moment in Joyeux Noël that caught my eye and made me think of another favorite Christmas movie set around wartime. At one point, the chaplain plays a prank on a senior officer and takes him via a shortcut that ends up taking him right through the latrines.
Ew.
And it reminded me of the beginning of White Christmas, when General Waverly has his young driver take another general back to headquarters via the shortcut, which he says the general won't know isn't the way back to headquarters for about an hour and a half. And I'd really love to know if that moment in Joyeux Noël was inspired by White Christmas, because it's the first thing that I thought of.
So overall, it's been really interesting to see how the 100th anniversary of the War's End has been commemorated throughout the past few years. In 2017, the Dreadnoughts, a folk punk band, who I love so much, released an album called Foreign Skies, and it commemorates World War I with songs about various historical events, from a polka inspired by the German troops who refused to push into Paris and instead had some parties with the French.
Let's polka!
to a song written from the perspective of an executed deserter. They dedicated the album to all the people who lived through the First World War and to those who didn't make it through.
That is fairly all-encompassing.
The past half decade really saw some very moving commemorations of the war, and my favorite was one that took place in the summer of 2016 on the centennial of the first day of the Somme. On July 1st, approximately 1,500 young men dressed in World War I era uniforms fanned out in small groups to public spaces across the United Kingdom. If someone spoke to one of them, he didn't say anything in response. He would simply offer a card with the name, date of birth, and rank of one of the 19,000 British soldiers killed on that first day of the Somme, July 1st, 1916. There were also some commemorations of the Christmas truce itself. In 2014, Prince William dedicated a memorial, selected from among 30,000 designs submitted by school kids, that depicts a handshake encased by the frame of a soccer ball. That same year, the British grocery chain Sainsbury's released its Christmas ad, a lovely short film about the truce that I will link to in our show notes. British Christmas ads get me in the feelings every single time. I am a marketer's dream.
No surprise. When I watched 1917, what upset me the most was seeing the dead horses and the poor dead dogs strewn about on the battlefield, just like I was horrified to find out about what happened to the poor kitty after the Christmas truce.
There, there, dear.
And I'm not the only one who hates that so many animals have been the casualties of human conflicts. On June 8th, 2018, the War Horse Memorial was unveiled in Ascot, in Berkshire. It's dedicated to the millions of horses, donkeys, and mules killed during World War I. Chelsea pensioners, Royal Artillery members, Lifeguard members, and the Household Cavalry Band were all present, and a wreath was placed there on the Queen's behalf. Additionally, if you go to Hyde Park in London, you can see the Animals and War Memorial. It has several inscriptions, including, "From the pigeon to the elephant, they all played a vital role in every region of the world in the cause of human freedom. Their contribution must never be forgotten," as well as, "They had no choice."
Finally, we're sure you know that museums and historic sites are facing some existential struggles this year, given how heavily they rely on visitor revenue. During each episode, therefore, we want to recommend a public history site related to that episode that you should support with your dollars, your Facebook likes, your Instagram follows, and hopefully someday soon with a visit if possible. For World War I history, there's no better resource than London's Imperial War Museums, a family of institutions that were actually founded while World War I was still on to capture that history in real time. I was fortunate enough to visit it on my honeymoon last winter, as one does on their honeymoon.
Nerd.
And we spent 3 hours on the World War I floor alone. And what stuck most clearly in my mind from that day was an exhibit about military censors reading letters home from the front, something that we see in Joyeux Noël. And one of the censors prepared a report on British troops preparing to launch the Somme offensive that read, quote, "They know that they are saving France and also that they are going to die on the spot." And I sobbed in the middle of the museum. There's just a lot of crying in this episode. So for our British listeners, hi there. We know we have a couple of you. Drop us a line. We really highly recommend a visit. But for everyone, IWM has fantastic online resources, and we would love it if you supported them in any way that you can. Last year on New Year's Eve, many of us joked that we were excited to see the 20s come back around again. Look what you did. Regardless, we want to wish you all a happy new year and an excellent, safe, healthy 2021. Thank you for a great first year of podcasting. This is Costume Drama Rewind. Thanks for listening.